Taylor Lorenz, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
The first thing I want to ask you is, why did you do the Adam Friedland show before Doomscroll?
Dude.
Follow-up question. How could you do this to me? I thought we were friends. Can I ever forgive you?
I didn't get the invite for season one. I didn't even make the cut. I think Brace or someone told me they were going on your podcast. I was like, oh, Josh has a podcast. Maybe I'll get the invite one day.
Long-awaited welcome, finally, at long
last,
to the
show. I wanted to build
the
anticipation.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good way of phrasing it. Yeah. I saw Adam a little while ago, and he was like, oh, I've got Taylor coming up. And I was like, fuck, we've got her a week from now. Okay. On a more serious note, what is a beat? In the world of journalism, what do we mean when we call something a beat?
I think a beat is basically like what you cover. So it's sort of like what your specialty is, or like the area that you report on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What would be maybe a few examples of those? Like, is sports a beat, for example, fashion?
Well, it can be large and small, right? So like technology is a beat. Consumer tech is a beat within technology. Same thing with like sports, right? You have sports reporters, and then you have somebody who's like Baxter Holmes, who's the NBA correspondent for ESPN, who just only covers the NBA.
And these different writers answer to a certain editor in a certain vertical.
Usually, if you're working at like a staff job. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sometimes you're going to write for the other verticals, because especially if you cover tech, it affects everything now.
That's exactly where I'm going to bring us with this. Yeah.
So I'm ahead of you.
I think you and I met around like 2018, right? You were at The Atlantic at that time.
I think it was, 2017 or 2018. 2018, probably.
Okay. So you go in the next few years, Atlantic, New York Times, Washington Post. Now you're independent, you're on Substack. How has your beat changed?
I had to rack up all those legacy names so I could quit. It's changed. I've had the beat for a long time. I've pretty much always been writing about what I write about. I cover tech, but it's really sort of a media tech beat. It's like the attention economy. It's new media, as they call it. It's changed so much because it's... I don't know that it's actually... I think what's changed is that... It's become, the things I report on have had higher and higher stakes.
Yes.
So that's terrifying because I cover a lot of insane stuff. But I think internet culture, which is broadly the beat that I write on, was not seen as a serious beat throughout the 2010s. Yeah. And it was sort of seen as this like backwater.
Did it get serious?
Well, I think I started to realize that it was serious when I was covering the 2016 election, because Donald Trump is very much a phenomenon, internet phenomenon, and the way that he was leveraging, media was radically different than the Democrats. But I think people started, like people in power really started to take it seriously in 2020 when COVID began, because it put everyone online, and finally these people in power, Silicon Valley, had to like acknowledge like online culture. And I think they were like, oh my God, there's actually a lot here. And they also started to like really value the attention economy, because they realized they could profit from it,
right,
through crypto and other things like that.
People were hesitant to say that memes won the 2016 election. And it's been interesting now to see how seriously, it's almost as if there's been this like backlog, like a dam of just how seriously we need to take stuff that's happening online. And in 2024, the dam burst. And now it's like, oh shit, we have nearly a decade of stuff to catch up on.
Yeah.
How have your politics developed in the last few years, since you've been watching this space, since you've been seeing all of these developments?
I feel like I'm going crazy because I'm like, I don't think my politics have changed, but the world is so reactionary. And maybe it always was, and I was delusional for a while. I think I was so political when I was younger, because against the Iraq war, like the Iraq and 9/11, and I grew up outside the city and seeing what was done. And I had like, you know, friends from the Middle East, and I was like, so I hated George Bush. Like, and I think maybe as a millennial, like, I don't know, I graduated into the recession, and that was kind of radicalizing also in its own way. But it also felt really vindicating, because I felt like, okay, all these bankers are going to lose everything, and then they kind of didn't.
Yeah, good
but
luck.
Like, but I remember, like, also being like, yeah. But But then maybe I drank the Obama Kool-Aid a little bit too much, like in those early 2010s years where I kind of thought like we had moved past a lot of stuff that we maybe didn't. And so, yeah, but now I'm just so surprised at like all these people. Like I have a lot of beef with a lot of mainstream liberals because I'm like, oh, you guys stand for nothing. And I guess they've always stood for nothing, but it's just like the genocide and stuff is so apparent. And I think same with the media. Like when I went to work at the New York Times, I remember being like, I can't believe I'm working at the New York Times. Like they excused war crimes. They did all this evil stuff, but like they're totally better now. And then realizing like, oh my God, no, they're not, like actually. So maybe it's always been this way, but definitely the past few years I think has like opened my eyes a lot more.
Was there a specific politicizing event in the last few years?
Well, I think like everyone, like COVID radicalized me a lot. Not even radicalized. I would say the only thing that changed in terms of my ideology is my beliefs around disability justice, because I didn't know anything about it before. And obviously I had like disabled friends that would talk about things, but I didn't really understand it. I supported Medicare for All and all this stuff, but I really didn't understand how oppressed disabled people are in America and how hard it is for them and how both sides of the political spectrum from the farthest left to the farthest right are deeply bigoted towards disabled people. And just the way, I think it was also just like 2021, watching people just drink Biden's Kool-Aid of like, you know, actually COVID totally just like magically disappeared and everyone needs to go back to work because Delta Airlines told us to. And you know, these same people that a year ago understood the concept of airborne transmission of a virus, you know, this dangerous disease, really pivoted to this like hardcore denialist thinking that was, and adopting very far right beliefs around disability and eugenics and all of this stuff. And I would say now huge portions of the left believe in eugenics, and that is disturbing. And so I think like that's changed a lot. Because I think I also just didn't know as much about that issue. And now I am familiar with the struggles of disabled people and I advocate very hard for disability justice.
I'm going to try and pill you on the internet driver's license. I will try my best. I'm rolling up my sleeves to give it a shot.
Wait, you're going to try and sell me on it?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm serious.
Okay, let's hear it.
So,
no, Josh, are you pro identity verification online? Tell me you're not.
I think when I serve it to you this way, you will be amenable to this idea.
Oh my God, I'm going to throw you out the window. Let's hear it.
You haven't seen this one coming, I absolutely assure you.
Okay.
So many years ago, myself and a few peers started to have these conversations about the teleological developments of the internet, whether they were moving towards centralized entities or decentralized entities.
Yeah.
Right? The Peter Thielism that crypto is libertarian, AI is communist.
Yeah.
That with the massive aggregation of data, you can do things like economic planning, you can do censorship and debanking, and you can do all of these things that work in advance of the market, but do not allow for personal private data.
Yeah.
Versus something that is totally cryptographically sealed that makes that completely impossible. Mm-hmm. And in, I think, mid-90s, there was a proposal that came from France learning how to regulate the internet. They called it the internet driver's license, which was the same way that you take your test, like when you're 16 to get your learner's permit and whatever, that would be something administered by the government where you would take a kind of bare bones media literacy test, like a multiple choice quiz.
Of course, and just ensure that you're properly, you know, pro-American and that you have the right ideas to get on the internet.
So this is the hazard, that some of those things, that kind of nationalism, jingoism, like all of that kind of militarism is going to be baked into the existence of the state.
Of course.
And all of the negative things that states are, you know, capable of. We're seeing a lot of it right now in the Middle East.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the alternative to not having that state institution verify the identity is a private corporation. And what we started to discuss in this period of 2015 was that...
That's not the only alternative.
What is the other alternative?
Well, you don't need a private corporation to verify your identity to use the internet.
How do you verify it otherwise?
You don't need to verify your identity on the internet. You don't need to. You can visit a website without... You don't need to verify your identity. What do you mean?
Well, your personal server, your personal cloud, like it's sealed with your password, for example. That's what I mean by identity verification within a corporation, that it's like you on your account and I'm
not.
If
you set up an account, right, but I'm arguing for an internet where we don't have to set up accounts and we don't need to, we don't want an internet. Right now we have an internet where you don't have to make an account to access the internet. You can access the internet freely and openly. Thankfully, this is what many people do, right? You don't have to sign into the internet like it's, you know, with your path, and then everything that you do is tracked online. That would be terrible and dystopian. It would be used. It is being used, right? So we don't want to create a system where you have to sign on to the internet by giving your identity, and then your every single thing that you read and do is then tracked and used against you, often in the court of law, right? Or by DHS or something. Mm-hmm. So we want anonymity on the web. And we know as well that anonymity on the web, it, like removing anonymity doesn't mitigate online harassment or anything like that. Mm. We know that it sort of actually helps a lot of discourse in terms of speaking truth to power and stuff. Now, listen, I'm not saying everybody can be anonymous forever. Like, that's great. Like, I reported on Libs of TikTok identity at that point, right? Like, somebody has an anonymous account. It's newsworthy. We're going to find out that person's identity, right? Like, I think that happens all the time. But it's so crucial to have anonymity on the web for freedom of expression, because you can't speak freely if every single thing you do is tied to your government ID forever, documented, available to the government, especially an authoritarian government that is increasingly seeking to use speech
You're sounding a lot like a liberty supremacist right now.
Okay, well, I think as a journalist, I care so much about civil liberties, because you can't do journalism without, you know, and we know.
Right, but so this is the thing, is that the civil liberties are underwritten by the state. They're not given to you by the corporations. The corporations can deplatform you as they see fit.
Yeah,
and I think what you're describing actually sounds a lot more like the privatized vision of the internet that is Urbit, actually. So what I would prefer to happen was state institutions that subtend the existence of the internet itself, and then through political struggles, secure those rights. Like, we have a lot of things that are not technologically dependent, right? Someone sends you a letter in the mail. If I intercept your mail and open it, that's a felony offense. It doesn't depend on the cryptography of the envelope.
Yeah.
And I think that those things are
right, but you're making an offline analogy to some, like, what's the online version of that?
The online version of the envelope?
Yeah.
Is that we put people in jail for opening your email, and you get a yourname@usps.gov email address that's given to you as a right of citizenship.
We have that already, though, don't we? We have that.
No, we're all using Gmail. We're all using Google.
Oh, you want nationalized. Okay, I understand what you're saying. Yeah. You want a nationalized internet, basically. Is that
I want
saying?
A nationalized platform.
Nationalized platform. Oh,
I want Statebook. What we decided going way, way back, like 15 years ago, talking about these things, was that it would be a better terrain to wage those political struggles within the existing framework of democratic institutions than to cede that to the private platforms, because what they were trying to build essentially was like a sovereign Google that did not need to answer to the United States government.
Okay.
And so what I see is, like, yes, there's all sorts of political struggles that occur, but, like, you know, the end goal for any libertarian organization is to not have any form of verification, not driver's licenses, not age of consent.
For libertarians, yeah.
Yeah,
for, yeah.
Yeah. And which is the apex of this private corporate state.
If you take it to extreme, yeah. If you take it to some extreme, sure. There's that brand of libertarianism. Although I think that's authoritarian in its own way, and I don't think that that's truly...
It's monarchy.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I said.
Right.
Yes.
No, but the crypto is monarchy.
Yeah, that's
the state,
I agree.
The WeChat AI planning is not monarchy.
Oh,
the centralized version is not monarchy. The decentralized version is monarchy.
It's monarchy.
Yeah,
okay,
indisputable private power, sovereign power for the individual.
Yes, we agree on this. Yes, yes. I think that you are in theoretical academic land, and I'm talking about laws today that will dismantle journalism and silence activism online. And I agree that I think there's actually a wide set of policies that could get us to a less profit-driven internet and get us to, I think, the internet that we both agree on. But in the meantime, what we should not do is further reward these companies by saying, hey, you know how we previously said you couldn't collect data on children? Mm. Now we actually want to mandate that you collect biometric data on children. Mm. And yes, you guys can sell that too. And yes, we've now also created this entire third-party identity verification data brokering industry that can sell even more data and make even more money and target you in even more ways. And also now the government can get access to all that data. And now the government can seize that information and use it against you and use your consumption patterns on YouTube against you in a court case or things like that. We don't want that. So I think we want to, and I'm talking in the next 2 years.
Okay.
Okay? We want to preserve speech online. We want to preserve the right to free expression. We want to preserve the ability to do activism online, right? Like we want to preserve, and we want to make it so that there we can speak truth to power on the internet. The internet is, right now, the most powerful political tool of our time. We need to not just cede it to the far right, which is what is happening right now. But long term, I think there are tons of things that we could do to make a more, you know, make a more public, basically an internet that serves the public good and that is some sort of governmental like utility that that is free and accessible to everyone, that is not profit driven. And that doesn't have these like weird, you know, for-profit incentive structures, which is, I think, what makes all of those companies so terrible.
You were politicized leading up to the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
What were some of those early formative experiences? What kind of documentary films, books, what kind of influences did you,
It was, I had like tutored an Afghan kid for a while. And I think when I saw, and I had friends that were from the Middle East, and I had wanted to go to school. I had wanted to go to college also at American University of Beirut, where one of my really good friends went. And I think I just saw the way that it was crazy after 9/11. Like people were talking about Muslims and Arab people and people from the Middle East, and I just was like, that's not true. Like, what are you saying? Like, this is just racism and this is crazy. And then I knew people that signed up for the army and that was terrible.
Oh, wow.
And they were like traumatized. And I just, I have never supported war generally. Like, and I think George Bush was such a terrible president and such a horrible person. And I just like, I didn't really consume a lot of news media. It was more just like, I mean, people didn't really follow the news in the same way. Like maybe I read like Newsweek or something.
Well, we didn't have like news feeds on our phone, so it was different. Yeah.
But I do remember like talking to people in college, and I went to a big state school and I went to University of Colorado in Boulder, so everyone's protesting something every day there. Yeah. And people were very active and I was just like hearing, you know, people would just say things and I would be like, that's terrible. And like, like Iraq wasn't even involved in 9/11. Like, why are we even going into Iraq? Like, these are innocent people. And that was before we even knew that much. And then of course, like the Abu Ghraib and all the other stuff that came out and just realizing the military was really evil, I think. Mm-hmm. And that America was the bad guy. I think there was so much also like what really bothered me as someone from, born in New York City, grew up most of my life in and outside New York City. And after 9/11, these people, like, it was a little bit stolen valor of, like, New York, where it's like, I mean, I knew people whose parents died in 9/11. Like, I experienced New York as a kid. Like, we visited the pit when it was still the pit, like, huffing in God knows what. Like, you know, and then we had all these, like, shameless politicians and, like, random-ass people in wherever parts of the country, you know, being like, we got to go to war and, you know, 9/11, never forget. Da, da, da. And it's like, you're not even from New York, you know, like, like you don't.
The nationalism post 9/11. Okay.
It really pissed me off. And I think I felt it really like it felt like you're using this city that is mine, that I grew up with, that is like sort of my home, as this like which like you don't care about people in New York City. And
New York
Rudy Giuliani was
host to some of the biggest anti-Iraq war protests.
Yeah, but then these other people all over the country had like all these opinions about it. And it was like, do you even know anyone who died? I only knew my friend's parents, which not like we were some close person, but like, I don't know. It felt like real and personal. And so that kind of bothered me, I guess. I just think I just was like, oh, you guys are using this as a pretense because you just want to go to war.
Yeah.
And all the Freedom Fries shit and the, remember God, the red, fries. White, and blue M&Ms, like all the candy. Remember the candy?
I forgot about that.
Trick-or-treating that Halloween, like the candy was all red, white, and blue. I remember I had like this red, white, and blue bag of M&Ms forever.
I remember David Cross did like a stand-up special where he like made a few jokes about being anti-war and shit like that. But there were not as many like incidents or moments in pop culture where people were like protesting, I think, as vigorously as they are now.
You know what I loved back then? This is so corny. You know what I loved?
What's that?
I loved The Onion.
Oh, yeah.
I loved The Onion. And they used to print it and I would read it and it was so good. And they were anti-war. Mm. And The Daily Show.
Right.
So lib, like millennial. But that was kind of like the only... Like, and they weren't even so radical. I don't know what was being said, but it like, there wasn't that much, like, media to, like, consume. Yeah, David Cross. I don't remember. There was, like, comics that would speak out. And I hated when people said, oh, you're anti-American or you hate America.
Right.
You know, you don't support George Bush, you hate America. Mm. And I was like, I fucking hate America. Like, it sucks to live here. We should make it better so that we don't, you know... I don't know. I was born here. I don't have to love this country.
Hi, everybody. This is Joshua Citarella. What you just heard is an excerpt from this week's bonus episode. If you want to hear more and get access to the full catalog for Doomscroll and other podcasts, you can support the show on Patreon or Substack, where I'm putting out new episodes every week. This is an independent show. I don't do any advertising, so your support is really what keeps this project going. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.